Chapter 4, Oxford. We left Northampton in 1954, when I got a job as a representative for a London-based company selling raw materials to bakery and catering establishments. We already knew the Ecclesia from my frequent speaking visits, and settled there quite happily. Some of the characters associated with the early days of the Oxford Ecclesia come to mind a little larger than life, and it has also had many of our best-known brethren pass through the university. Brother E.H. Tipping was a great worker there in the early days, and built their present hall. He was a big man in every sense of the word, and one of the comparatively few brethren in the pre-war years who could be described as wealthy. At any rate, he appeared so to his poorer brethren when he arrived to speak at Northampton in a chauffeur-driven car. Such luxury was quite outside our experience. He is probably best known for his hymn, "The days are quickly flying and Christ will come again," though one wonders how many today even realise that these words were written by one of our own brethren. I recall speaking at a fraternal gathering at Oxford just after the war, while still at Northampton, at which Brother Tipping was president. He liked me, or at any rate he liked my speaking, and if Brother Tipping liked anybody in those days, they were invited to speak there, for what he said was law. So I got invited 3 years running. Fortunately, I had the sense to decline on the third occasion, realising that it was becoming ridiculous. On the occasion in question, we sang his hymn, and he commented that when he wrote the words we have just been singing, he little thought that 50 years later we should still be waiting for the Lord to come. Now, another 30 years on, he himself is asleep, with every conflict ended and every sorrow past, waiting for the cry to go up triumphant, "The Lord has come at last." It reminds us how very careful we should be in making prognostications about the time of Christ's return, for generations of believers have expected it in their lifetime, and like Brother Tipping, are now asleep. It is the fact of his return that is important, not the timing. On this same occasion too, Brother Gilbert Smith was one of the speakers, and he used this hymn to illustrate his address in an outrageous and amusing manner. Speaking on the signs of Christ's coming, he explained that near his home in Birmingham there was a railway station which the oncoming trains approached round a bend, so that passengers awaiting its arrival knew of its approach before it came into sight by the rattle of the rails, and were able to get themselves ready beforehand. So, the rattle of the rails was like the signs of the times. We knew Christ was near, because we could hear the rattle of the rails. And after all, he added, we have sung in our hymn, "The days are quickly flying and Christ will come again, with all his saints attending, triumphant in his train." Brother Jack Stead was another of the Oxford stalwarts. He had been brought to the truth by Brother Tipping in the early days, together with a number of other young men from the same chapel. I believe it was Methodist. For a time they used to go to the chapel in the morning and to hear Brother Tipping at night, but eventually they left and were baptised into the Christadelphian faith. This made a big hole in the Methodist congregation, and the minister called to see Brother Jack to try to persuade them to return, if only on the part-time basis as before. But when he found this was not possible, he suggested that at least they might send their contributions to the collection. It was at Oxford that I first met Brother Dennis Gillett, who was to become such a close friend and fellow labourer. Dennis had been a Roman Catholic before meeting the truth. Not just a perfunctory mass attender, but a really dedicated Catholic. Indeed, he once told me that he had entertained the idea of training for the priesthood. At that time, Dennis did not have a car, so we used to arrange our speaking appointments as often as possible to coincide so that we could travel together. And we also were invited to a great many fraternal gatherings together, so that in some places we became known as the Terrible Twins. We enjoyed these journeys together, often accompanied by our wives, and needless to say had a number of adventures in our travels, not always pleasant, though always sustained by Dennis's perpetual good humour. I recall one occasion when we were both speaking in Birmingham Ecclesias on a Sunday and had arranged to meet at the railway station to catch the last train back to Oxford. For some reason we had not used the car on this day. The train was due round about midnight and we met as arranged, only to find that it was no longer running. The next train was somewhere around 4:30 a.m. and we sat rather cold and disconsolate on the platform, anticipating a 4-hour wait and a sleepless night. I remember Dennis said to me, "All those brethren and sisters we have been speaking to today, tucked up in their nice warm beds, would be horrified if they could see us now, sitting here for hours waiting for a train to take us home." Now, it has long been a guiding principle with me that it is better to be doing something than passively waiting for something to happen. So I suggested to my companion that we might set out to walk out of Birmingham towards Oxford and perhaps somebody would offer us a lift. So we picked up our cases. No Christadelphian speaker is complete without its briefcase. And off we set to walk to Oxford. I suppose we had walked for about half an hour when we came across a fleet of 3 coaches loading up soldiers who had evidently been out on some kind of exercise, and as the coaches had Oxford on the front, we asked if they were in fact going there. The driver of the first coach told us they were, but when we asked if we might have a lift, for which we offered to pay, he stated that it was forbidden to take other than servicemen. Disappointed, we resumed our walk. Presently, however, we were overtaken by the first and second of these coaches, and then, to our delight, the third stopped and offered to take us. He had heard our request to his mate in the first coach, and although he confirmed that what he had said was correct, he would be prepared to break the rule for us in view of our predicament. Perhaps he also thought it a way of making little money on the side, but we will give him the benefit of good intentions. So, like Jonah, we paid the fare, 10 shillings each, which was quite a lot at that time, and very gratefully settled ourselves in 2 spare seats among the weary soldiers. I whispered to Dennis, "I wonder what they would think if they knew we were a couple of conscientious objectors." But anyway, we got back to Oxford about 4 a.m, in time to get home and have a couple of hours sleep before setting off to work. So my philosophy of action was again justified. For if we try to do something, we give God something to work with. But if we just sit back and do nothing, he cannot help. The people who didn't try to get their sick to Jesus did not get them healed. He could do no mighty work there because of their unbelief. A similar plight occurred on another occasion when we were returning from Birmingham by car, this time with our wives. Late at night we ran out of petrol, coming through Shipston on Stour, about halfway between Birmingham and Oxford, and found all the garages in darkness. We wandered around trying to find one that might be knocked up, but it seemed hopeless. Then at last we came across another motorist in distress whose car had broken down and who wanted a lift to Oxford. So we had a car and no petrol, while he had petrol but no car, not one that would go at any rate. It took very little imagination to arrange a marriage, and we siphoned out his petrol into our tank and all got safely back together. He was grateful to us for the lift, and we to him for the petrol. Needless to say, there was no shortage of conversation in the car on these speaking journeys, and I remember on another occasion Dennis and I were alone on the journey back from Coventry, engaged in animated discussion. We came through Southam, about halfway back to Oxford, and after some time, Dennis interrupted me in mid-sentence to ask me whether it were possible that the lights in the distance could be Oxford City. I suddenly realised that far from being Oxford, we were heading straight back into Coventry. With all the talking, I'd taken a wrong turn in Southam, and we had doubled back on ourselves. I'm sure that other speaking brethren have had their own adventures and mishaps, and could probably cap these stories. These kinds of things are just a part of a speaker's life, but how many of those to whom they minister are aware of them? And if we experience such inconveniences in the work, how grateful we should be to be allowed to have even so tiny a share in the sufferings of Christ, who for our sake experienced not only inconvenience, but torture and death. Our time in Oxford was a bittersweet experience. We were very happy in the meeting there and made some very good friends. My new job was turning out quite well, and I was offered promotion to area manager. But Agnes, my wife, was becoming more and more ill, and the shadows beginning to lengthen. So I refused the proffered promotion, which would have necessitated being away from home more often. In the end, after 4 happy years there, she succumbed to the inevitable and died one night on one of her many spells in the Radcliffe Infirmary. I had visited her the same evening and was to have brought her home again the next day, but at about midnight the police knocked me up to tell me I had to go urgently to the hospital, and she died as I arrived. I will not begin to go into details of what this means in terms of personal suffering, for those who have experienced it will know, and those who have not will never understand until they go through it themselves. She had been a wonderful wife and a devoted mother to 3 growing children, and her sweet and faithful nature lives on in the memory of a great many brethren and sisters who enjoyed her companionship and were the recipients of her love. Later I was to have my life repaired and my circumstances eased by marrying my present wife Ingrid, who had had a similar experience in earlier life and had become a close friend of the family for a number of years. I will say no more about these deeply personal matters, except to say that our second marriage, as it was in both our cases, has been a great joy and blessing to us, and a good recommendation to those who may find themselves, through the misfortune of life, similarly placed. With the Lord's blessing, such a marriage can be totally successful, and need not in any way diminish the love and joy in the remembrance of the first partner. It is not good that the man should be alone, the Lord said in the beginning, and it is still true. The companionship of a good partner in the Lord is of inestimable worth, and if one is sadly left alone through the icy finger of death, and by God's grace later finds another brother or sister to share the present wilderness wandering, this is a cause for much thanksgiving and joy. Brother Harry Taylor was recording Brother of Oxford at this time. In all these personal sorrows and joys, he had been one of our staunchest friends. He had been through the same experience of bereavement himself, and was a brother in every sense of the word. I first met Harry when I went to Reading as a young man in 1938. He was recording Brother there. He and his first wife, Dorothy, were very kind to me, and I spent many happy hours discussing things connected with the truth around their table. Dorothy was a lovely woman with a very alert mind, but unfortunately death took her away from husband and family as it later took Agnes. There is no explanation apart from the general mortality of mankind. It is no use to say, why should this happen so early to such good people? The sword of death devoureth one as well as another, and there is no discharge in that warfare, as Solomon declared. Harry had married again, and his second wife, Bernice, being a qualified nurse, they had taken up the challenge of becoming wardens at one of the Christadelphian homes for the elderly. But again death intervened, and for a second time Harry was left alone. His experience in helping to care for elderly brethren and sisters had left him somewhat chastened and disillusioned, for he found them in some cases as cantankerous and selfish as those who had no pretensions to Christianity, and it saddened him. There are, of course, a great many Christadelphians who have managed to grow old gracefully, many of whom in our homes for the aged, and whose old age bears testimony to a lifetime of genuine discipleship. But there were some, he found, who boasted of the length of time they had been in the truth, and who wouldn't miss their daily readings for anything, and yet whose attitudes to their fellow residents and to other people outside was as selfish and self-opinionated as if they had never known Christ. This Harry took as a lesson for himself and a warning to others. He did not feel that it was enough to excuse such behaviour on the grounds of old age, saying as we tend to, "Oh well, you get like that when you are old." He suspected rather that it was the real person showing himself at last. For when one is younger and has more control of oneself, he used to say, it is recognised that some forms of outrageous and overt selfishness are quite unacceptable, so feelings are repressed for fear of what people may think. In old age, however, the social defences are down, and all the repressed egoism comes to the surface, and the pettiness and jealousies which become sometimes apparent are the reality now come to open view. It is a frightening thought, and had anybody less kind and Christian than Harry said it, I might have been prepared to dismiss it as a jaundiced view of life. His conclusion was that if you want to avoid being like that in old age, you had better start now. If all my Christadelphianism does for me is to mask a selfish and egocentric reality and make it seem acceptable, then woe betide me when I'm too old to hide it any longer. I suppose the great judgment will be something of the same order, when the secrets of the heart will be revealed. It is one of the aspects of our community that frightens me a little, that we are so sure that we alone have the truth, and are sometimes, even from the platform, openly contemptuous of others, yet in the fruits of gentleness, humility and love, seem often to be behind those whose doctrinal position we so readily condemn. I have known brethren boast that they have been doing the readings for X number of years, and have read in those 30, 40 or 50 years the Old Testament once and the New Testament twice each year. yet never seem to ask themselves what it has all done for them, or how much it has developed in them the Spirit of Christ. It was of the Pharisees that the Lord said, "You search the Scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, but you will not come to me that you might have life." John 5 verse 39. Unless all our reading of the Bible and listening to endless exhortations and attending fraternal gatherings leads us to a closer association with the very Spirit of the Lord, it will not only be useless, but it will be our condemnation. The Lord has said so, Matthew 7:21-23. The fear of Pharisaism may have made some less willing to pronounce anathemas against other Christians than their bolder brethren would like. But in the end, it may well be that a gentler judgment will be more becoming, and perhaps it is better to err on the side of gentleness, being aware of our own failings, than to arrogantly assume that we are the people and wisdom shall die with us. Having written so warmly of Brother Harry Taylor, it is a sadness to record that he left our fellowship and died in what has become known as the Old Pals Fellowship. I suppose it is inevitable that a community based on an exclusive doctrinal interpretation of the Bible should find itself torn with continual strife. But what a tragedy it is. Over the years I have found myself separated in these divisions from brethren and sisters who were very dear to me, and it seems as if we must always have some contention stirring up the body. Of course they are sincere. Of course they think their particular point of view is vital to the preservation of the faith. So they go off and leave us and start yet another splinter group, usually with its own magazine, and henceforward live, it would appear, mainly to justify their stand and prove how wrong their late brethren are. So friendships are broken, valued associations are lost, and spiritual growth is stunted, and witness is fragmented, and all in the name of preserving the purity of the truth. This is such an important matter, and our community has been so torn by it in its whole history, that we shall look at it more closely in the next chapter.